Okay, guys, welcome to our third session today, which is titled Divine Authorship and Human Authority from Bible to Rabbis. This is a session that I really, really like. I mean, not I like all of them, but this one I like because I think it puts a fantastic context on the evolution of Judaism. And as a prelude, let me say this. If anyone starts a sentence with the term or with the words Judaism says, you should already be skeptical. Judaism doesn't talk. Jews do. Okay? Judaism says nothing. Jews do. And when Jews talk throughout Jewish evolution, they say different things at different times. They need to be understood in their own context. They address sometimes different audiences. That is not to say the Jews do not try to respond to unifying ideas, but to come and claim or to have this preconceived assumption that there is such an entity as Judaism, and that there is an all-inclusive consensus about what Judaism says or aims to say, is misleading, to say the least. Example of which is going to be today's session, when, as we are going to talk about the transfer of authority from two major, arguably the major models in the evolution of that abstract entity known as Judaism. And those two models are the biblical model versus the rabbinic model. Okay? Everybody has the source sheets? All right. So let us delve into the pool. When we look at the biblical model, and when I say biblical model, for the purpose or the purposes of this particular discussion, I want to make a clear distinction here, which is not viable in all lectures. So I want to make sure I'm not giving you an absolute truth, but a contextualized truth for this, for the subject matter at hand. I'm referring to the anything that is before the destruction of the Second Temple and after the destruction of the Second Temple. So the dichotomy is somewhere around 70 CE, the first century CE. Okay? Everything before, we're going to call, in general, the biblical model, and you'll see why. And after, everything after, we'll call the rabbinic model, and you'll see why. We'll start, obviously, with the biblical model. And here, I want to claim or suggest that when we look at the Bible, or better yet, if we want to be accurate, if we look at the books that were chosen to constitute the Bible by the rabbis, and we'll talk about it later, the Bible itself is not a biblical production. An interesting thing to know, at least to be aware of. We look at the 24 books, we find something very, very interesting. That we have a relationship, if you remember, we discussed this on the first session, we have a relationship between the God of Israel and the different constellations of the people of Israel. And after you heard the first session, so even when we talk about the God of Israel, we talk about the different constellations of that God and how it is to be understood. And the people of Israel. And one can say that in many forms, and I don't want to oversimplify, but in so many words, the Bible is occupied, or those who codified and assembled the biblical writings, those that were chosen to constitute the 24 books, what we call today the Hebrew Bible, among other things, its main concern is ethical. You remember I told you about theology. We talked about the backbone of the theological discourse. is God created the world for a specific reason, and the backbone of that reason, or the teleology behind creation, is ethical. The human is perceived as a part of God above. It is perceived as a potentiality of the divine, whose purpose on earth is to put forward or to realize the divine potentiality that exists within the human, to make the world a better place. In pre-modern language or rabbinic language, it's known as Tikkun Olam. And Tikkun Olam, do not be confused, Tikkun Olam first and foremost starts with Tikkun Adam. In other words, you have to fulfill your own self in order to become a meaningful member of the community. The Bible is concerned with this ethical trajectory through the medium of a perpetual negotiation with the divine between the people of Israel and divinity. And how do they converse with divinity? Do we find a single place in the entire Bible where the people of Israel as a whole converse with God? Don't be shy. No, even in Sinai, which you are, I understand why you said that. Sinai distinguishes itself from other forms of revelation by virtue of being a communal revelation. You're absolutely correct. But if we read the story, we see the people of Israel quite tellingly telling Moses, go and you speak to him because we are to... They don't hear what God says. Moses hears, right? Moses hears. And by the way, if you follow the story, you see again that the actual story, the actual biblical narrative is quite different from the Charleston Heston Ten Commandments version, where we have in our minds Moses going to Sinai, talking to God. I'm not even talking about the Mel Brooks version of it. God has given you 15, sorry, 10 commandments, right? No.
For you.
Right, huh? Moses doesn't go to Sinai once. Moses ascends to Sinai thrice. Yes, three times. Because first talks to God. God says to him, go down, see if the people of Israel would like me to be their God. It's a very, very interesting point. God doesn't force itself on the people of Israel. The idea of the covenantal pledge between the people of Israel and the God of Israel is based on the people's consent, acceptance of divine authority. That's a major, major element in Jewish thought as well, and its theological backbone. Goes down, asks the people of Israel, are you willing to do it? They say yes. He goes back up, reports to God. God says, great, go, prepare the people. 3 days, you won't come near a woman, blah, 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 blah. Moses then goes back up third time, and then the whole spiel begins. So three times he goes. Okay? Now, if we don't find any place in the entire biblical narrative where God speaks to the community of Israel, then how does this covenantal relationship realize itself in the biblical stories?
Through mediators.
Who are the mediators that we find in the biblical stories? You're right, mediators. Who? Don't be shy, there are plenty of them.
Shem and the Nevi'im.
So first of all, you said Nevi'im, prophets. More.
Abraham, Isaac, and
Jacob. The patriarchs. Moses, we'll call him a prophet, right? Yeah? What else? Give me figures, not names, but positions.
Okay, the priests.
Priests, Kohanim, Nevi'im. What else?
Angels.
Okay, yeah. Some sort of beings that are neither human nor divine, but they're angelic. And we talked about the evolution of those in the first session. What else?
What category is King David?
Kings! Monarchs, absolutely. It's a category. Kings, what else?
The Torah.
Okay, the Torah, we'll deal with that. Significant negotiator.
Science,
you said?
Science.
Okay, Ototu Muftim, right? We have signs that usually, and we'll see that, Ototu Muftim usually come to substantiate the validity of a mediator. They're not mediators in there. Dreams are all of these. What else? Besides humans, what else? Think outside the box, or should I say outside the tabernacle?
Bilam's donkey?
Okay, so we have animals, but those, okay? Others, we have institutions. The temple. right? In the temple, you see inner circles of sanctity. The closer you got to the Holy of Holies, right, the more sanctified you become, until you get to the point, right, the actual point that is uber amplified at a certain juncture in both space and time. Yom Kippur, where the right, where the high priest goes there, and if you know the Talmudic, the Midrashic story about the high priest in Yom Kippur who goes into the thing and he has a golden string that is 10 meters, 30 feet long, that is attached to him. So if he has any kind of blemish, he would be struck dead. Nobody is allowed to go in, so they can pull him out. And so it's a juncture of space and time. What else? Any other? These are all signs. I'm talking about categories. You talk priests, prophets, kings, temple, Torah. One more, my friends, very, very important, is the land of Israel as a whole. And I want to introduce a term here. You call them mediators, rightly so. It's a valid term. I would like to introduce the idea or the term axis mundi. Axis mundi. The axis of the world. And you'll see why I'm using that term. I didn't invent it. Many, many greater scholars than me use it. There's a great article about it by Professor Art Green from Brandeis. Axis, A-X-I-S, mundi. Mundi is world, right? Axis mundi, the axis of the world. And let us look now at the texts, and I want you to see or to experience together with me how the biblical language reflects this notion of axis mundi. So let us start with the first axis mundi, the priests. Who'd like to read? We'll go with the English. Go ahead, dear.
And bring down Aaron to meet Aaron, my brother, and his sons with him, from among the children of Israel, that they may minister unto me in the priest's office, even Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Itamar, Aaron's sons.
Aaron? Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Okay, and now from verse 4 on, I highlighted it for you. This is not in the original, we don't have right. Now pay close attention to the garments of the priest. Okay? Pay close attention. Yeah.
And these are the garments which they shall make, a breastplate and an ephod, and a robe and a tunic of checker work, a mitre and a girdle. And they shall make holy garments for Aaron my brother and his sons, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office.
Mm-hmm.
And thou shalt take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the children of Israel, six of their names on the one stone, and the names of the six that remain on the other stone, according to their birth. And thou shalt put the two stones upon the shoulder pieces of the ephod, to be stones of a memorial for the children of Israel. And Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord upon his two shoulders for a corner. And thou shalt make a breastplate of judgment, the work of the skillful workman, like the work of the ephod. Thou shalt make it of gold, of blue, and purple, and scarlet, and fine twined linen shall thou make it. And the stone shall be according to the names of the children of Israel, 12 according to their names, like the engravings of a signet, every one according to his name. They shall be for the 12 tribes, and Aaron shall bear the name of the children of Israel in the breastplate of judgment from his heart, when he goes in unto the holy place for memorial before the Lord continually. And thou shalt put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be upon Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord, and Aaron shall bear the judgment
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Now, from what we just read, please describe to me where are the names of the children of Israel engraved on Aaron's garment? Two places, which are
on the shoulders
and
on the breastplate.
Fantastic. On the shoulders, before the Lord, and on the breastplate,
before the people of Israel.
Here is the garment that literally presents Aaron, the high priest, as an axis mundi. He is now a commemoration of the covenantal relationship between God and Israel. Wherever he goes, right, there are two things that are with him at all times. The names of Israel vertically, and the names of Israel horizontally. And he is now the mediator, the negotiator, the one whose responsibility, and by virtue of that, the ethical charge based on him, right? His responsibility to negotiate the covenantal relationship between God and man, or between God and Israel. Okay? So here is one example of an axis mundi. Let us continue now to the second type of axis mundi, melachim. Ephod is a type of a vest.
Breastplate.
No. A breastplate is a different thing. Ephod is made of cloth, from whence came the modern Hebrew word afuda, which is a vest. Okay. Today we have in army Ephod Magen. Is that okay? All right. The Urim and Tumim are the two plates upon which the six stones on each one was put on the chest. Okay? So those are the horizontal ones. The kotafot, the vertical ones, and the horizontal ones. Okay, so now we have a priest, literally as an axis mundi. Who would like to read now the kings? Don't be shy, guys. I need your help because I don't want to lose my voice. We have a lot of texts today. Go ahead.
There is nothing in the ark save the two tables of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, when the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. And it came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place, the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister by reason of the cloud. For the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. Then spoke Solomon, the Lord hath said that he would dwell in the thick darkness. I have surely built thee a house of habitation, a place for thee to dwell in forever.
Let's stop here. What is King Solomon referring to, obviously? The first, right? The first temple. The first temple. Built circa somewhere around 970-965 BCE. Right? 10th century BCE. Okay, continue.
And the king turned his face about and blessed all the congregation of Israel, and all the congregation of Israel stood.
Okay, now here's a question for you. When Solomon speaks in this text, where is his face pointing? If you look at verse 14, obviously it gives you a clue. So he's facing who? He's facing? He's facing God. As, well, the divine representation, right? He's facing something that is holy, right? He's saying whatever he's saying. He's receiving whatever he's receiving, right? And then what does he do?
He turns around.
He literally turns around. He shows his face now to the people of Israel and doing what?
Blessing.
Giving them a blessing, right? Now here, and that's a whole lecture of its own, the notion of face to face in the biblical narrative. I have a whole lecture about that, so we won't get into that today. But what I do want you to understand is that the idea of seeing the face, the notion of seeing God's face, is something that is kept only to those of that were chosen by God to be able to see God's face. And here I'm talking figuratively, because you know that with Moses, for example, who is allegedly told us, and no one who saw God face to face, even when we look into that in the Torahic narrative, so that he didn't actually see God face to face. However, he did come to a very intimate level of knowledge of God. This comes also from the socio-political climate of the biblical narrative itself. If you follow the biblical narrative, you see, for example, I'll give you an example. The same Moses, when he comes to Pharaoh, if you remember, and tells him, let my people go, blah, 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 blah. And Pharaoh is upset with him. I'm not imagining. Go and check out the Bible. We all have the same version. Pharaoh says to him, get out of my palace. Do not show your face, or you will not see my face again. For on the day you will see my face, you surely die. You'll surely die. In other words, the idea of seeing the face is a sign of great intimacy and divine acceptance. Okay? Idea of divine endorsement or kingly endorsement. This is why when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai, what features on Moses' face in result of descending from Sinai? His face is radiant, right? His face is radiant, right? And what is the commandment now, the tzivui that God gives him? When you go down, you should put a veil over your face, right? And you have numerous artworks, mostly Christian, that deal with that idea. And by the way, the idea of Moses talking to the people with a veil over his face because they couldn't withstand this aura, this incredible light. And you should read it light, but it's an enlightenment. That's what it is, in fact, right? And I'm saying in fact here not to suggest that this is an authentic event, but the in fact is the idea of how you should understand the idea of radiance in the face. The same thing transferred into the rabbinic world, where the priests, when they give the priestly benediction, they put a talit over their face, so the people of Israel, because the people of Israel cannot withstand the light, which is the result of that sanctified condition at the moment of the priestly benediction. By the way, exactly the same idea had informed Islam. And since according to Muslim theology, Muhammad is rendered the seal of prophecy, the end of prophecy, whereas Moses is perceived, or Abraham, and after that, Moses is perceived as the master of prophets, Muhammad now is always presented in Muslim art as the one with the veil over his face. I charge you, go and check Muslim art. Whenever you find a figure with a veil over its head, in other words, a person whose face is covered by a veil, even if you cannot read Arabic, that's Moses. That's Muhammad. And Moses next to him sometimes, with his face revealed. Because now Muhammad is the one whose sanctity is concluding the chain of revelation. Just so you understand where we're coming from. At this juncture, what happens here is the king functions as an axis mundi. He absorbs the divine light, which should be understood as enlightenment. And then, what does he do?
Blesses.
Not just blesses. He turns around, shows his face to the people of Israel, and allows them, figuratively speaking, to nurture from his presence at this juncture. By the way, this whole idea of a people who do not turn to God to face him, as it were. We talked about the prophets, for example, as people who are very busy, very concerned with the ethical deviation of the people of Israel. Did you ever think why Israel are called by almost all prophets a stiff-necked nation? Because that's what God sees. Turn, the prophets say. Turn, so I can see you face to face. You're a stiff-necked nation because the prophet now talking on behalf of God says to the people of Israel, that's what God sees. Your necks, your back, turn. How do we say to repent in Hebrew? Lachzor b'tshuva. Turn, come back, show me. And then when you read Isaiah, he talks, eventually you will come to Zion and meet God eye to eye, face to face. We'll be able to converse again. This is why one of the punishments that rabbis talk about all the time is if you turn around, God will also hide his face from you. Hester panim. You're familiar with that term? Hester panim? Hiding of the face, which is in Rabbeinu understood as withdrawing from the covenant and allowing calamity to overtake or what have you. We won't get into that. But what I want you to understand here is that the king is understood It's a profound exis mundi. Someone who perpetually negotiates this kind of a covenantal relationship between God and Israel. Yeah. It depends on the context. If you want to generalize, one can definitely say that the king is usually understood as a leader on a political level and a military level, whereas the priest has the spiritual pulse of the nation. Usually also the priest is there in order to be the watchdog of the king. So you can see it with Samuel and Shaul. You can see it with Nathan and David and Bathsheba, the famous story, right? But at no point do we find that there is only one exis mundi. The temple itself is an exis mundi itself. I mean, the entire... So we have a plethora of exis mundis. What I want you to understand that in the Bible, the presence of an exis mundi is indispensable to realize the covenantal relationship between God and man. One cannot imagine a relationship with divinity, understanding the covenant. What should we do? How should we deviate? How should we lachzor betshuva? How should we repent without the presence of an exis mundi of one nature or the other? Usually more than one. Usually more. Wait, we're talking about the biblical. We're talking about the biblical model. Okay? Let's continue. Nevi'im, prophets. Okay, here the Torah, Deuteronomy, is concerned with something that actually is really a problem. Somebody comes and claims to be a prophet. How do you know that person is a prophet? By the way, we have prophets, we have males and females in the... No, we have not just males. Somebody comes and says, God has sent me, and now you should do A, B, and C, and D. The people ask justly. They say, look, he talked to you. Usually he talks to you in dreams. It's a very solitary experience when a God speaks to someone, right? It's not like everybody hears. Usually they are rendered loonies when they come and say, right? So the people say, okay, we accept the notion of a prophet. How should I know that this prophet is a true and not a false prophet? What is the answer here? It's pretty self-explanatory, although in a minute I'll show you that it's far more complicated than that. What does it say, basically?
Let's see if what he says comes true.
Exactly. The answer of divinity is quite simple. If he told you that this shall happen, and it happens, then you know that this person enjoys, in so many words, divine endorsement. Right? His words are endorsed. And indeed, when we look, for example, at Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 3, let's see if Samuel is rendered a true prophet. Who would like to read? Go ahead, dear. Okay, and the Lord appeared again in Shiloh, blah, 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 blah. So how did all the people know that Samuel was a prophet to the Lord? Because if he came and said, it's going to happen to you, it happened to you. Sounds pretty simple, right? Pretty straightforward. Now, my friends, without getting into a whole course about prophecy in Israel and the myriad of complexities that stem from that notion of prophecy in Israel, let me just suffice it to say, first of all, that the misconception of prophets as soothsayers, fortune tellers, crystal ball handlers is prevalent, and it's completely wrong. Prophets in the biblical narrative have no knowledge of the future, but rather have a knowledge or an insight of a possible future depending on the behavior in the present. In other words, they come and say, look, God wants you to go from A to C. You decided to go from A to D. And based on that, since I have an intimate relationship with divinity, an acute sensibility to the ethical trajectory which God wants, I am telling you now that if you're going to continue on this path, you're in trouble. However, if you repent, if you deviate, if you do this, none of this shall come to pass. In other words, prophets do not deal with an absolute outcome, but rather a possible outcome. To make things even worse, if you think about it, two things. In the words of Abraham Joshua Heschel, a prophet is a person chosen by God to be rejected by men. So there is an absurd, almost paradoxical condition in the prophetic world, because a prophet is someone who was chosen by definition to put an uncomfortable mirror in the face of a nation. No prophet ever came to the people and said, listen, my name is Zohar. I want to tell you, God loves you. You're doing great. See you later. That's not a prophet. That's a politician. Okay? So a prophet is someone whose raison d'être is to agitate. A man chosen by God to be rejected by men. To make things even more complicated, if you think about it, a successful prophet is someone whose prophecy did not come to pass. Ah. Yes. Now, I come to you and I say, my dear, as a prophet, there is a disparity in my world between sight and vision. I see what you see, but in my vision, I transcend beyond what you're capable of seeing, beyond your event horizon. And I'm telling you, continue this way, and your trajectory is quite gloomy. You take my word seriously. You repent. And that trajectory does not come to pass. Now you have the legitimacy to ask yourself, I still don't know if this guy told me the truth. My friends, read the book of Jonah and see what happened there. In the beginning of Jonah chapter 3, Jonah is upset with God and he tells him, you made me look like a liar. And God punishes Jonah because Jonah obviously did not understand the whole idea of prophecy. A prophecy is not a matter of personal ego. It's a matter of changing a trajectory of a nation at the expense of your own well-being. A prophet is someone whose one eye is set on divinity, just like the ephod. One eye, the other one is set on humanity, and his mouth articulates the disparity between one eye and the other. He looks like a Picasso painting.
Sounds like a mother.
Huh?
Sounds like a mother.
Hey. In other words, a prophet is someone whose destiny is to agitate, to reflect, and to articulate possible trajectories, which by definition are hard to swallow. Read the prophets. Read Heschel's book called The Prophets. It was his dissertation. It's a fantastic book. The agony of the prophetic condition. The disparity between experience and expression. Of what I see and what I'm able to articulate. Why are so many prophets fall before God and say, I'm not worthy? I cannot transfer or transmit the splendor of what I see. It's a point of linguicide for so many of them. I'm borrowing a term from Alexander Meher. Words are a dilution of the experience. This is the disparity between experience and expression. It's a profound, lonely condition to be a prophet. But the prophet is an axis mundi. He or she are the ones whose radical proximity to divinity renders them people who live simultaneously in multiple universes. And there is never peace between them. A person destined to live in an internal turmoil. Well, first of all, even in the Bible, we find people who claim they are prophets, or people who, for example, in the days of Saul, the people who are mitnabiim b'machane, people who practice some sort of magical rituals. I mean, these were very much, until today, why are we going to the... There are still people today that believe in such things. I don't want to judge, but there are still people who go to...
Oracles.
Yeah, and oracles, and they go, this is part and parcel of the social religious climate. People need someone to tell them the truth, whatever that may be. Or people need someone to tell them what God wants from them. Those people, however... We also have to make a distinction, which I didn't make because that's not the topic of the day. So I didn't go into the higher or deeper resolution of prophecy. I just gave you the over the overview. We definitely have prophets in the biblical, the classical prophets, who deal with an absolute outcome. But usually that absolute outcome is messianic by nature. In other words, they're already talking about the day to come or the last day or what have you. Within the socio-political climate of the people of Israel, we usually find those who are more what you called the classical prophets. In other words, people whose main charge is ethical, and usually they give the people of Israel or the kings of Israel a way out. In other words, they tell them, look, I'm giving you a prophecy, but I'm not giving you an absolute truth. But absolutely, when you look at the overall climate, there were many, many others who called themselves prophets. And by the way, Shmuel is called a prophet. I mean, he's rendered a prophet in the Hebrew, just like the others. So, for me, what is more interesting is how were they perceived in their own context? And how were they written about by other people? And if you look at Samuel, for example, he's rendered someone who is definitely an exis mundi as far as God is concerned and as far as Samuel is concerned, up to a point that Samuel does something awful and goes against God and calls him from the underworld, if you remember. So that there is a definite presence of those who claim to be soothsayers. But my argument is that the classical prophet did not deal with that. That was not his or her main concern. First, let's understand the prophets before we understand how people reacted to them. And why was it so important for the rabbis to say that after the destruction of the temple, prophecy had ceased to exist? We'll see why. And you'll see that there is much more than just a theological assumption here. Whether we like it or not, hardcore political reasons. Who am I to tell? I don't even know if Isaiah lived. I don't even know if we're talking about a real figure. I'm not saying we're not. But I don't know if we're talking about a real figure. I don't know if this is a pseudonym. I don't know if it is the reflection of somebody who spoke 800 years later. I have no idea. What I'm concerned about is, first of all, how were prophets perceived in the writings? And here I want to combat this perception that people use until today. What am I, a prophet? How can I know the future? And it has nothing to do with it. The idea of a prophet is a person who is, in so many words, interested in tzedakah. Tzedakah. What is tzedakah?
Justice.
Good. I'm very glad nobody here said charity. Because charity is a means to tzedakah. It's not tzedakah. Tzedakah is the perpetual attempt to reach social equilibrium. To bring the different elements of the universe, especially on a social level, to some sort of a harmonious utility. Now that's tzedakah. Charity is one way, but not the only way. Far from it. Okay? The prophet is a lawyer. The prophet is a social worker. The prophet is someone who is perpetually agitated by the disparity between sight and vision. He's somebody who's forever agitated. That's a prophet. But I don't want to turn this into a course about prophets. That's it. The tension is his condition as an axis mundi. He's an axis mundi, and that's the tension that the prophet feels. Okay? Let's now move on to the next level, another axis mundi, and that is not a person, but rather the land of Israel. Okay? And the land of Israel. Let's see what the book of Deuteronomy, the end of the Torah, just before they're about to enter into that land which they had not yet seen, says about the land which you are about to possess. Look what it says. For the land whither thou go in to possess it, is not as the land of Egypt, from whence ye came out, where thou didst sow the seed, and didst water it with thy foot, as a garden of herbs. Look what it says about that land. It is a land which the Lord thy God cares for, the eye of the Lord thy God, the eyes of the Lord our God, are always upon it, from the beginning of the year, even unto the end of the year. In other words, the book of Deuteronomy seems to put the land of Israel as a category unto itself. And not only a category unto itself. The land of Israel is perceived, in so many words, as a theography and not just a geography. A theography, I mean, it is the land that takes an active part in the covenantal relationship between God and Israel. And I brought for you here a few examples. The first one, circumcision. What is the act of circumcision? Cutting off the foreskin, right, of the male infant as a sign of covenant between the God of Israel and the male, right? There is a type of circumcision that we are not very aware of, and that is, look at that. The first one in Genesis 17 is the circumcision that we all know of, right, of the male. And look at Leviticus 19. And when you shall come into the land, and shall have planted all manners of trees for food, then you shall count the fruit thereof as forbidden. Now, forbidden in the English, in the Hebrew, is with a foreskin. Orla, the same foreskin of the penis, the same word. It has a foreskin. 3 years shall it be as forbidden, literally uncircumcised. Unto you it shall not be eaten. And in the fourth year all the fruit thereof shall be holy, for giving praise unto the Lord. But in the fifth year you may eat it, the fruit thereof may yield unto you, blah, 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 blah. In other words, for 3 years, the fruit of the land of Israel, not of outside the land, within this theography, the fruit is considered uncircumcised. And on the fourth year, it becomes sanctified by this kind of act of circumcision. You are giving it the covenantal ritual, which renders it, first of all, allowable for the priests, and on the fifth year, edible. Okay? So here is the fruit of the tree of the land, which undergoes some act of a covenantal pledge with a foreskin. Let's look at Shabbat. Shabbat on Exodus 31 is one of the places in the Bible when we hear about the covenant of Shabbat between the people of Israel between the people of Israel and God. Okay, and now let's look at Leviticus chapter 25. Just flip to the next page. And the Lord spoke unto Moses in Mount Sinai, saying, speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them, when you come into the land which I give you, then shall the land keep a Sabbath unto the Lord. This is known as the Hilchot Shemitah. Hilchot Shemitah means every seventh year you should give the land rest. In the biblical narrative of Leviticus chapter 25, the wording is, allow the land to keep Sabbath. Instead of every week, every seventh year. Okay? And if you do not allow the land to keep the Sabbath, what shall happen to you? If you continue reading, I didn't put it here. For every Sabbath, for every sabbatical year that you didn't give it, I will banish you from that land, and this land will remain barren for the amount of time which you had not allowed it to rest. So here's the land that undergoes circumcision, keeps the Sabbath, right? And there is another example, which I did not put here, and it is tzedakah. Tzedakah itself. One of the words or the terms, some of the terms that come back in prophetic language over and over and over again. Do not oppress the orphan. Do not oppress the widow. Do not oppress the poor. Blah, blah, you know that, right? What are you supposed to do when you harvest your land and you forget to saw the corners of your field? They're known as leket pe'ah v'shichecha. What are you supposed to do?
Leave it
to the orphan, poor, and widow. And here's that if you pick the harvest and it falls from your tractor, what are you supposed to do?
Leave it.
Okay? Allow the land to partake actively in the act of tzedakah. So there are three examples, all of which are covenantal by nature. Brit, milah, or foreskin, Shabbat, and tzedakah. The land negotiates the relationship between the people of Israel and the God of Israel. The land is an axis mundi in its own right. Okay? Now you talked about miracles as well. And we mentioned miracles as a sign of divine endorsement. So here's an example from Jeremiah that glorifies God. And of course we have many of them, so I just gave you one. He praises God and says, God who set signs and wonders in the land of Egypt even unto this day, and in Israel and among other men, and made you a name at this day, that did God bring the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt with signs and with wonders and with a strong hand, with an outstretched arm, and with great terror. In other words, in the biblical language, wonders, miracles, and signs come to do what? To prove what? That? Not just prophecy. There were also miracles to kings.
The greatness of God.
The greatness of God, but more than that, the greatness of God and the divine endorsement of whatever is happening. That's what I want you to understand. A miracle suggests an infusion of divinity, of the absolute into the temporal, of the meta-historical into the historical. It is a manipulation of nature. It is a manipulation of science. It is a manipulation of everything we accept as normal in order to tell mortals God's hand was at this. Whoever is speaking and is backed by a miracle is perceived as enjoying some sort of divine agreement. Yes?
So your definition of miracle is something outside the norm. In other words, living for a prophet, okay, who's living in the here and now, who understands and clearly sees the present reality right now, has a clear understanding if there's this divine connection to make the prophecy of saying, if you keep moving in the direction you're going, you have deep problems. So, but he can see because he's here to see. Okay. Most of us are so preoccupied that we're not here. But living here is a miracle in and of itself. There's a clarity that is experienced, that is understood, implied in that experience.
Well, that's beautiful. I'm not sure that will be a biblical rationale. You just remind me of a wonderful graffiti that I once saw in Rehova Masger next to Teatron Tmuna, which is a great place, by the way, if you ever have a chance to go there. And it said in Hebrew, it said, "Ata chai ve'adayin mechapes nisim," you're alive and you're still looking for miracles. It really struck me. I said, wow, what an insight. What a beautiful insight. I mean, here you are saying how life sucks, and you don't understand the contradiction in terms. A prophet, and you're absolutely right, and we'll talk about it in a minute when we move to the rabbinic level. A prophet is never perceived as a divine. He or she are always a human being, because the idea is that justice and the social justice, the trajectory of social justice must come from a human being. Otherwise, you leave human beings with the pretext or the excuse of saying, oh, easy for you to say. If you are divine, of course you can live like that, da 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 da. But I'm merely a mortal. If a mortal speaks like that, then we have something to talk about. So you're absolutely correct. A miracle comes to give some sort of a communal validity to the very intimate connection between the prophet and the people, or the king and the people, or whatever it is. The point here to understand that in the biblical language, miracles are an established phenomena that comes to show the reactions or the relationship between the divine and the earthly. And the reason I'm saying that is because miracles are also a form of an axis mundi. And now, after we've established that, and it's now 7:30, now we have to move to the second temple destruction. The jumping. Many things happen in between. But I had to give you a whole hour of a context so we may understand once and for all, maybe, why is the destruction of the second temple still lamented until this very day? For many of us, I don't know how many of us keep Tisha B'Av. I don't know many of us really try to... I'm not judging, I'm just saying. How many of us sympathize or at least try to imagine the extent of the devastation? Unfortunately, most people, when they think about the destruction of the Second Temple, they think exactly about that. The destruction of the Second Temple. They don't understand that the destruction of the Second Temple is not a destruction of merely an institution. It is a destruction of a whole Jewish paradigm. It is a point of no return. In other words, my friends, as we start the second half of this lecture or presentation, the destruction of the Second Temple is the end of the biblical model. It's the end of the known Jewish way. I want you to get this because I want you to understand what the rabbis faced when they needed to ask themselves, how do we continue from this point on? It's very simple to look at it from 2010 because we already have 2,000 years of rabbinic Judaism. But I want you to go for a second to the year 71 and ask that question then, and then you'll understand the extent of the devastation. Why? Look at page number 5. Each and every known axis mundi that is responsible to negotiate the relationship between the people of Israel and God, tell them about their envisioned trajectory, and guide them towards a better fulfillment of the divine pledge, is destroyed. Temple. The sacrifice, I haven't even talked about that. The sacrificial offerings which also offered the priesthood. The land, you're exiled. No more royalty, no more kings, no more prophets. Again, no temple, no sacrifice, no Kohanim, no land, no royalty, and no prophets. First of all, if you look at the biblical language, 80% of the words that are used to describe sacrifice etymologically stem from roots that have to do with drawing near. Korban is karov, tnufa is lehanif, to lift, and harama, to bring forward. Okay? By the way, that's another lecture, but when you read Genesis 22, the binding of Isaac, right? It starts with the verse, Vayi achar hadvarim ha'ele v'Elohim nisa et Avraham. Most translations translate the word nisa into tested, and God tested Abraham. If you read Rashi, Abarbanel, and others, they take a completely different. Nisa is from the word nes, which is not a miracle, but rather, and we have other examples, nes vadegel, nes is a banner. A banner is something that is lifted up. So Abarbanel says, or Rashi says, nisa milashon harama v'gdula. Nisa is from the word to lift up, to bring forward. Abarbanel says it more poetically. He says, some say that the samech should be replaced with a sin, and the hay should be replaced with an aleph. So nisa and nasa is actually the same idea. The word nes, by the way, in the Bible means degel, banner, which is lifted up. So now they come and say the whole story of the binding of Isaac should be understood completely differently. God does not test Abraham, but rather lift him up to see a certain truth. And Abraham knew right from the start where this whole trajectory is going. The one who was being tested, actually, in the binding of Isaac is Isaac. That's a different lecture. So what I'm telling you here is that what we're talking about when we talk about sacrifice is a ritual that aims to draw near to God and in result negotiate the relationship with God and know where we need to go. That's why I called it another access movement. When you say Judaism is about the sanctity of life, I can tell you that if you look again at the evolution of Judaism, if you look at the biblical narrative, now, there are many examples, one of which is, for example, the book of Joshua, which might raise an eyebrow. In other words, whose life are we talking about and whose sanctity of life? So that's one question. And I don't want to unpack this at this moment because it's a whole lecture and a whole debate unto itself. Second, the value of human life is not equal to the value of animal life. That's another issue. But, for example, if you look at the book of Joel, the prophet Joel, chapter 3, if I'm not concerned. There is a verse there that says, Neshalma parim sfateinu. Let our lips pay sacrificial homage. Which the rabbis then will translate. By the way, this very verse will become one of the major subsoils for the rabbis to come and say, with the destruction of the temple, liturgy, prayer, now becomes the sacrificial. And that's why Shacharit, Mincha, and Ma'ariv, which are the three prayers that you pray a day, are taken, precisely the words, are taken from the three sacrificial offerings in the temple. The morning offering was called Shacharit, the noon offering was called Mincha, and the evening offering was called Ma'ariv. That was sacrifice. Okay? So the whole idea, we'll talk about in a minute, of turning now the actual offering into a more liturgical, verbal, less violent element, in retrospect will also be a rationale that leads you to ask your question. But I'm not sure that once you look at the biblical narrative in its own context, it was as adamant about the sanctity of life as we would like to believe. In other words, I would challenge a romantic rendition of that notion. It is an evolving one. That's as much as I can say in such a brief time. But where I want us to be at this point, my friends, is I want you to look at page number 5. After everything I just talked about. At page number 5, where it says temple, sacrifice, priest, blah, blah, blah. And I put it visually like this for you, because I want you to suck in the presence of absence. I want you to tackle for a second the emptiness of the post-destruction era. At that moment, we're finding a nation for whom the entire model upon which it grew is irrelevant or obsolete. We don't have a temple. We don't have priests. Sacrifice is obsolete. Many of us are banished from the land, this theography. We have no kings, obviously. There's no land, there's no king. And as if that's not enough,